This week we have an episode I'm super excited about. We're talking with Mike Korolik from Tipping Engineering. If you read any of the structural engineering magazines, you have definitely seen this firm come up. Not only do they do impressive work, they have great application side, so this is sort of software sketchulation if you've heard of it. They also have been working through a really unique and efficient lateral system that we recently saw published and we had to learn more. So let's talk to Mike and see what we can learn from this.
The Structural Engineering Podcast.
I am Mike Korolik. I am a structural engineer, but I'm a part owner of Tipping Structural Engineers in Berkeley, California, where I have spent most of my adult life. I grew up in Lodi in the Valley in California and went to Berkeley for my undergrad and master's, and then joined Tipping 20 years ago this year, actually.
Oh.
So I've been there all that time. Over the course of those years, I've focused a lot in my professional work on nonlinear analysis, nonlinear time history analysis for seismic. I've been involved in a few of the innovative solutions that Tipping has come up with, and I've gotten into some programming, and we now have a side company, Tipping Applications, where we market software. That's a little bit about me, but yeah.
That is super exciting. I've been wanting to talk with Tipping for a long time, just in general, but also if you were doing nonlinear stuff 20 years ago, this is like you were on the cutting edge of this. So thanks for developing this, I imagine.
Yeah, no, I learned all this in my master's, and I was very excited to get into it. And Tipping seemed like a wonderful place to work. I worked at a number of companies before I got to Tipping, and to me, it felt like Disneyland. I've said that before to my colleagues. Like, it's just been great, a great place for me. So I've really appreciated the opportunities that I've had here.
I can imagine. I mean, Tipping does really unique projects, so I'm always happy to see them pop up in Structure Mag, which is sort of the root of this conversation, is you guys had an article about mast frames, and I really wanted to learn more, because I think the idea of a mast frame is so unique in structural field. Instead of we just know what LAR loading is and what brace might fit this category, and it feels a lot like catalog picking, right? But mast frame is creative, and it is a heck of a lot more unique than, I don't want to just down talk anything else, but I just have to say some of the, like a BRB system is wonderful, but it's not unique, right? And and this is actually using some creativity and math sense to apply, to solve a problem in a different way. So I'm super excited to learn more about this and really happy that you're willing to talk about it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate, there are not many opportunities to find people who like to talk structural engineering. And so I am honored to share what I've learned. So thank you.
Perfect. All right. Well, let's start with the biggest, easiest one is I don't know if it's easy. What are mast frames? Can you give us the summary, basically?
Yeah. Well, the best way to think of it is to start with a conventional brace frame and get that in your mind. And usually, that consists of, some columns that are vertical, and then you have some diagonal members, which would be the braces. And I don't know, probably some 30 years ago, there was the development of the buckling restrained brace, which is actually a fascinating technology. I think it's amazing, an amazing innovation. And what that does is it basically allows you to have a brace that operates the same in compression and tension, are very similar in compression and tension, and it avoids the buckling behavior that was really problematic in just a normal any normal steel brace. The mast frame brace just basically adds a little bit of innovation to the conventional brace frame system, and it addresses what is a problem with really all brace frame systems, is that they tend to form story mechanisms, which means that once you have a story in the building where the braces start to yield, the deformations concentrate in that story. And that concentration leads to an amplified, we call P delta effect. So the gravity load tends to cause actually lateral displacement once you've got the building in a laterally displaced shape. And when you have a story mechanism, that P delta effect is amplified. And that's ultimately how buildings collapse, is through some sort of P delta mechanism. And then the mast frame, what it does is it couples amassed with a series of BRBs, or it could be dampers too. Anything that provides energy dissipation can be coupled with the mast. And really, all the mast is doing is just preventing the story mechanism. So it can be thought of like a rigid spine, you know, or a splint that bridges across the tendency to have a weak mechanism, weak spot. And it distributes the forces to the upper braces, and so that leads to all kinds of beneficial effects. It's much more stable than a normal brace frame type of system.
What is, just so I can have this in my head, what is the mast frame structurally like? Fit, you know, if I could picture this thing, is this stiffer steel members?
So what we do, we've done this a number of ways actually. So in practice, what we've done is we'll have, you know, you can imagine a chevron brace frame system, which is basically the diagonals, form sort of like an upside down V. And then, at the bottom story, what, we do is you have a chevron configuration, but then at the upper stories, you'll have a center column. You know, that basically is, you know, right there at the crotch, if you want, of the upside down V. And on one half of that frame, one half of that chevron frame, you'd have elastic steel members. So those would be conventional, usually very heavy. We've done them mostly out of W-shaped sections. So one half of the frame will be conventional steel. And then the other half of the frame will have the BRB diagonals, like a conventional system. And so the half of the frame with the conventional steel members, the W shapes, that side of the frame is the mast. That is the piece of the system that is designed to remain elastic. It can withstand all that the BRBs would try to impose on the mast. And stay elastic. So we design it for, you know, overstrength omega type forces, if you will. And so then that center column becomes a critical piece because it doesn't go all the way down to the bottom. And so then the half of the frame, I like to think of it as the right half being the mast and the left half being the BRBs. The right side kind of pivots about the column at the very base. And so that's sort of a different mode of failure. But the pivoting thing is an important thing. It's similar to flexural controlled shear walls, concrete shear walls, where you have a pivoting, you know, plastic hinge at the bottom. And then a, you know, above the plastic hinge, you have a essentially elastic wall. So it's kind of similar to that in that way.
I want to ask about some connection stuff, but first I want to do one more kind of big picture is, you know, what led your team to explore mast frames for Samuel Merritt University? You know, what about this project gave you the opportunity to develop something new?
You know, I remember sitting in my particular desk, you know, doing my work, doing time history analysis. By that point, I had done a few projects with time history analysis, and I had a professor, Steve Mahan at Berkeley. And so our office was just down the street from, you know, still is just down the street from, you know, structural engineering department at Berkeley. And so I remember sitting there one day and my, he's now my partner, Leo Panian, but at that point he was my manager, and Steve Mahan, came to my desk and they sort of presented this idea, and I immediately, latched onto it. I thought it was a great idea, although I didn't realize like the problem that it was solving necessarily, but I just, you know, I was just enjoying the process of trying something new. And so I would say it was actually Steve Mahan's research that led us in this direction. And Leo had he sort of takes the position of sort of the first professional developer, I think, of the system. But, you know, at that point, our company was very much into this pivoting, the idea of a pivoting sort of spine. We had innovated this system that was called a prop shear wall. This was before my time at Tipping, but Steve Tipping had developed this idea of a prop shear wall, which is very much like the mass frame, which is basically like a retrofit scheme where you'd put in a new concrete wall in an existing building, and it would be sort of a slender wall, like a 4 foot long wall, not very long. But it would have a prop, some sort of energy dissipating. And they were trying to do, you know, they were using like friction dampers and things, and they got a patent on friction dampers. But this prop, you know, would go up like 3 or 4 stories, you know, be like maybe a 5-story building, and you'd have this super brace, single super brace that would just kind of go up and attach to the spine. So I think that was probably, you know, one of the original ideas, and that was born out of just an idea of trying to do a retrofit that was less intrusive, that could be done, you know, more cost effectively. So that's how I think it sort of evolved, and that was our involvement really got going back then on 740 Hines for a private developer. And the whole benefit that we offered for them is that we were able to use the code, the get rid of the row value that was causing an extra brace frame, and using the mass frame efficiency, it allowed us to remove one of the frames. So that's how it kind of got started, you know, sort of took off from there.
Interesting. Okay, so you know, we have out of the book options that are, I would say, pretty good, but I do not really know the perspective here. But I'm just thinking about the style of building, right? A moment frame perimeter and a BRB core is fairly common, and I would assume pretty resilient as well. What benefits do you have compared to that system?
Yeah, well, both the moment frame and the brace frame system suffer from the same ultimate problem, which is that when they fail, and all buildings, you know, all built in seismic design, buildings are always designed to yield. You know, they don't remain elastic. So they're going to have their moment frame or their brace frame put through inelastic action. And the whole goal of seismic engineering, at least the conventional code approach, is to provide just enough strength so that the building is safe for people to exit, but it yields enough that there's a lot of damage. And the systems that have been preferred by the industry are ones that dissipate the most energy. And the ones that dissipate the most energy, that dissipation is damage. It's essentially yielding damage. And so the moment frame and the brace frame will both tend to form story mechanisms if you're not careful. Although with the moment frame, you know, the code has created a bunch of bumpers, the strong column, weak beam bumper, to make sure that to try to avoid the story mechanism. It's very catastrophic for moment frames to form the story mechanism. So they've kind of taken care of that. But then the moment frame is usually not strong enough to sort of force the brace frame to go through this mode. So I think the brace frame would still cause the moment frame to go through a story mechanism if the building is shaken enough. One of the key things about seismic is that we always find a bigger earthquake. Whenever there's an earthquake, it's always bigger than we expected. So we have to consider the fact that, you know, there's not just one earthquake. It's not a single determined demand. There's always something that's possibly bigger out there. And so then we have to think about, well, if something bigger comes along, what will fail? What is the weak link in the system? The mass frame, you know, what it does is it just makes the most efficient use of the lateral members so that you have a more inherently stable system, and it's more efficient. So it's just better in that sense. It's not a silver bullet. It's not infinitely stable, but it's just an improvement on what we've had in the past.
Yeah, my codebook version of structural engineering, I had always imagined that the BRB is the stiffer element or brace and would be forced to yield sooner. And then it takes a moment till the moment frame engages. So that is almost your weak mechanism. But this is my more rudimentary look at this.
No, it's true. The moment frame probably yields at about 1% of interstory drift. The brace frame is going to yield more or less immediately. The brace, the BRB system, actually, even though the braces look quite big, there's a fairly small yielding core inside the brace. And so they tend to be a lot less stiff than the conventional brace frames. And so then that does some things. There are lots of little nuances in there, but the proportioning that you have with the code nowadays actually forces you to have very strong columns and to have a relatively stiff frame compared to what it used to be in the past. And the thing that you have to also recognize is that when the BRB starts to yield, its stiffness will drop to a tenth of what its elastic stiffness was. Whereas the moment frame, it won't yield until about 1% drift. And the code drift limit is about 2%. So you're going to get halfway to the code limit before that moment frame starts to yield. And its elastic stiffness is actually significantly higher than what the BRB yielded stiffness is. So you can get some really interesting. I have one of my examples. It's totally unrelated to this topic. It's a little of a side tangent, but I had a situation where I had a moment frame on one part of the building and a wall on the other, and it was interesting where once the wall started to yield, it the drift favored the wall side instead of the moment frame side because the moment frame was very surprising to me. Anyway,
So that sort of leads to my original question that I'd said. It was popped in my head. The stiffness thing, if we have the strength following stiffness, how do you model and what considerations do you make when you model the brace frame when you model the mast frame? When you have a yielding element and then this larger, stiffer piece to keep this elastic, I assume the force can really jump around between these. And how do you think about how this moves and... I don't know. What do you have to consider when you model this, and what is your assumptions?
Yeah. So one of the probably the biggest impediment to the adoption of the mast frame is that it's actually quite hard to analyze without doing inelastic time history analysis. One of our former employees, he was a former employee. Now he's going to come back and join us. He went to study at Stanford. His name is Brian Astudillo, and he studied with Barb Simpson at Stanford. And they were trying to figure out a method for designing these mast frames without having to do time history analysis. And suffice to say that it's not easy. What happens is that when the building starts to shake laterally, because the mechanism is a pivoting mechanism, you get upper mode vibration in the mast. And because, you know, the goal is to try to keep the mast elastic, those upper mode vibrations cause a lot of chaos in the demands. So, you know, one of the things we've thought about and we haven't figured out yet is how to sort of calm down, how to fuse the loads in the mast while still keeping it roughly elastic. But to get to the short answer to your question is what I would do to get a first pass design is I go through the code equations for a BRB system. You'll come up with a base shear value, and sort of the size of the BRB that you need, for a conventional BRB frame. And, the mast frame is probably, you know, two-thirds of what you need relative to the conventional one. It could be even less. I mean, if you think about the R value that you have for a BRB frame is 8, which means that's a measure of how much inelastic behavior it can have before it becomes unstable. And the mast frame you can actually design with a lot less strength. You know, our value probably 12 or so from our analysis, and that's what we've done. And we've proved it with time history analysis. But then once you have, you know, if you take the conventional strength that you would need in the braces and you plug that into your BRBs for the mast frame, you know, maybe plug in 2/3 or even 1/2 of that into the mast frame in order to get further along to know, you know, what are the design forces for the mast, you know, what is the drift demand. There are there are ideas out there. There are papers out there to sort of estimate that, but they're not, it's not really well understood yet. That's the bottom line. So we just do it through time history analysis, and it's not a terribly difficult system to model. So, you know, it does take some getting used to, but it's not too bad.
And I assume the owner or client, either way, gets a serious savings in the foundation in this case, if you're using an equivalent R of 12 or something like that. You don't have to.
You can do it either way. So the owner can choose to have better seismic performance for the same, you know, sort of number of lateral frame sites, or they can choose to have the code level performance, so less good performance for fewer frame sites. I would say we've probably been somewhere in between on that spectrum, and I'm not cutting it as close as, or it's, yeah, cutting it down as much as we possibly could. You only, you know, sometimes you get to two frames in each direction. You can't go really less. So it's like,
yeah.
So, you know, that's where we've hit with, you know, several of these buildings. We've gotten them as small as possible, and you're still getting quite good performance.
I have a quick question just to, so people can picture this well. What is the width of a mass frame? The one that you did for Samuel Merritt. How big is this? Brace.
Yeah, they usually are trying to get your braces to be about 45 degree angles. So, you know, if you have a chevron configuration, then that means, you know, you basically take the story height and you'll multiply it by two, and that will be the width of your frame, roughly speaking, with one diagonal being. Yeah, one diagonal will be taking up one height of the building. The other diagonal takes up the other height of the building. So it's a 45 degree angle.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay. So mass stress contribute to uniform drift distribution across the building. I know you mentioned like these higher modes. Does that carry as far as the actual drift, or does it all shake out, I guess?
Yeah. So the whole point of the mast is actually to force the braces to all strain the same, to deform the same. So it's a rigid spine. So it causes all the braces to strain exactly the same amount, which is also to say that the interstory drift of all floors ideally is the same. So, you know, it's exactly the opposite of what normally would happen, is where you get a concentration of drift at one floor and then less drift at the other floor, which is kind of like a weak story situation. Lots of drift at one floor, hardly any at the upper floors. The mast system, it's equal drift everywhere. And all the braces are being utilized on every floor.
It's very cool. This is a much more impressive system than I thought it was going to be in this original. Yeah. I don't know. This is so unique, and that's very fun. All right. Can you tell us a little bit about how the mast frame system outperforms the conventional BRB only frame in terms of sort of drift control and redundancy?
Right. So it relates back to this idea of avoiding the story mechanism. So if you design a BRB, conventional BRB system, you get a set of story forces that the code says, you know, you have X amount of force at the roof and some other amount at the floor below and on and on. And then you'll size all your BRBs for these forces. But when the earthquake comes, it doesn't work by forces. It moves the ground. And so as it moves the ground, the floors above the ground have to, they either have to come along, or if they stay put, then the building starts to fall down. And so the BRBs are trying to pull the upper floors along with the ground. If one of those starts to yield, what happens is that its stiffness goes way down, like it's like a tenth of the elastic stiffness or something like that. And so then it tends to absorb all of the deformation. Now, the code story forces are trying to counteract that. They would say you design the upper braces for less force and the lower braces for more force, so that the lower ones are sort of pulling harder. And so that maybe they won't yield as readily as the upper ones. And if everything worked perfectly, then it would all be in balance. And and all of the braces would, you know, yield. But in practice, what ends up happening is one of the lower braces controls the design. It starts to yield, and it tends to absorb the deformation. At that point, you'll have the upper story braces that are effectively not being utilized. They're not yielding, or they're yielding very little. So you have this dual issue that's basically related to the story mechanism, where you're concentrating deformation, becoming more susceptible to collapse, and you're not utilizing the upper braces because they're not being taxed, because it's sort of like that bottom story is the crumple zone doing all the energy dissipation. Now, if you take the mast frame by comparison, that strong mast, basically, when the lower brace starts to try to yield, it cannot concentrate deformation because the mast is a splint. And so what ends up happening is, in order for a mast frame building to collapse, you have to yield all the braces all the way up the building. And so just right away, you can see, well, that has to be more efficient. You know, you're using all the braces rather than just relying on the ones that are lowest to the ground. But then on top of that, there's something that's kind of mysterious about how the P delta works. And you can kind of see it if you look at the numbers, but the P delta is a nonlinear relationship that we don't really focus on too much as engineers, but it just says that, you know, if something moves laterally and there's gravity load that's always existing and you have a lateral movement, that gravity load will tend to cause more lateral movement. It's a nonlinear phenomenon where the more you move, the more the gravity pushes you, and it's cyclical. It's a downward spiral. And for a pivoting spine, because the drift of the building is uniform all the way up, that P delta is muted. It's buffered in a way so that you're more stable. And so, you know, so what you have is a system that is inherently more stable because of the pivoting and the P delta, and it utilizes the braces better. And so those two things add together to allow you to either use less BRB for the same performance, or get better performance for the same BRBs.
Just such a cool system. All right, from the architectural side, because I'm curious on a few things here, what were the cost implications of using fewer BRBs in the system that you had and more steel in the mast frame? Is this a much beefier system that costs more, or were you able to save material quantity?
I don't know that a really rigorous study has been done on that. So I can give some anecdotal evidence. So like I mentioned, that very first project, what we were able to do is remove a frame from the system. And so, you know, if you just add up things, you pay for half the BRBs, but then you have, like you said, you have to put back heavier members for the mast. The BRBs happen to be pretty expensive as a unit because it's a proprietary, you know, thing. It has a lot of controls on the manufacture of those things, and they're almost single source, so they tend to be expensive. So, my guess is that they're a wash. Frame for frame, it's roughly the same cost. Okay, so then if you can remove a frame, then it's clearly, you know, whatever the total number of frames, you subtract one, and that's your percentage of savings. And I think that's pretty close. And I have, you know, the building that we did across the street from the Berkeley campus, it's under, it's under construction right now. That's a mast frame system. And then one adjacent to it, almost the same footprint, but it's one story taller on our building. The number of brace frames, mast frames, it's two mast frames in one direction and three in the other. And the reason we needed three was because we couldn't get them to be symmetrical about the center mass. And then in the adjacent building, which is a conventional, they have two cores basically of brace frames all the way around. So it's like double the amount of frames. So I think it's quite efficient. And then what ends up happening is you know, there are architectural benefits that can come of that, but I think a lot of steel savings from the mast frame just because you're removing frame sites.
That's, yeah, that makes sense. I assume removing one brace at least helps the architect with facade transparency, like it is taking.
Yeah, well, and these mostly just are, I mean, the SMU, we did have them on the end, but on the facade, but the oftentimes these are going in the interior of the building, so that's not such an issue. And I will say there is one benefit to doing the conventional BRB system that's an argument against the mast, is that I mentioned at the beginning, in order to make this mast in the way that we've been doing, you have a center column that goes up starting at the second floor and going all the way up. That center column is a problem. It doesn't, the architects don't like that center column.
Yes.
So I have to admit that, you know.
The one thing I was about to ask, were there any challenges integrating mast frames into architectural layouts?
Yeah.
Is that the one, the... Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, the center column is a problem. I mean, we've been able to work around it because you do have fewer sites where you need frames. But we heard some complaining. I mean, basically what ends up happening is the architect tends to like to use the chevrons, be able to pass a door through. And you can do that with a chevron in a commercial building, but you cannot do that if there's a center column. And so it's less flexible in that regard.
Okay. I'm going to ask about some construction items here and really detailing. What detailing strategies were used to allow mast frames to pivot and rock without overstressing gravity columns and the foundation attachment?
Yeah. So because it's a pivoting, the mast is pivoting about the base, we have to consider how that pivoting is going to happen. Is it just going to bend the column in an inelastic way? You know, columns can sustain a decent amount of inelastic bending without being a problem. Some of our designs, we've actually put a pin, a massive pin. I mean, we're talking like, you know, 4 or 5, 6 inch diameter pin at the base of the column to allow that kind of pivoting. In other sort of related systems, we've also had pins in the collector connections to allow again, it's the mast or the spine. If it's rocking, it has some vertical component of movement that, you know, typically collector connections that, you know, connect the rest of the floor to the frame, they might have a pin. And so the pin, it's an added expense. I can't say it's like a prohibitive expense if it's conceived early in the design. But if it's an add, later in the design, it can be a problem. It's a bit of a constructability, problem because the contractor likes to have columns that don't pivot and fall over. And so, you know, setting a column plumb while it has a pin at the bottom, and these are heavy members. It's a little bit of a challenge. We also have had, you know, a number of connections. These are, I think, more part of conventional design too, but we have some pretty large, anchorages that have to connect to the foundation. Again, I don't know if that's really very much different from conventional brace frame designs, but certainly we've come up with some ways to try to do that efficiently.
Yeah, I assume, much like a traditional BRB style system, these are just deep anchors going into the foundation system. It wasn't a very unique attachment there.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty much true. With the pin, you have some, you know, it's a little bit of, there's some challenges to getting, what happens is the pin is up above, it has some eccentricity, so the lateral load is hitting that pin, and so it creates a pretty large moment. It's just, it's not that much different though than a conventional system. There are pinned BRBs. If you've seen them, some manufacturers will choose to do a pinned version of the BRB. So, you know, some of the same sorts of issues, occur. And in some ways the pin is sort of a nice, architectural feature. I mean, this new building will have one of the frames. Yeah. Will be exposed. And it will have a pin in the BRB and a pin in the mirrored, mast diagonal. So you'll have a massive pin in a W14, like one of the largest W14 numbers that they make. So it'll be pretty interesting when they get that up there.
Gosh. The pin, you know, if the pin is not really attached, shear would be kind of hard to transfer through this. Is this pin look like a piano hinge style or, you know, a door hinge, whatever, that it can transfer shear through? It's like a little more connected?
Yes. Okay. Yes. A typical pin, there's an interplay between the diameter of the pin and the number of, like you said, the, sort of a piano look or a hinge with the fingers, you know, interlocking fingers is how those plates look. And then the pin will, you know, go right through the interlocking fingers of the steel plates. And yes, the shear is, it's all shear, going through that pin. The pin is put into tremendous shear stress. And that eventually, gets transferred into the anchorage, down into the foundation.
Yeah. It feels like it could lead to a pretty serious force at the anchors if you're, you know, all this load is transferring through the pin, which is a central location, and it's some distance above the base plate. It's cranking on this thing.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And so we, you know, it's important getting back to, you know, how to do the design safely. You really need to know what is the maximum load when all the BRBs are yielding and the earthquake's happening. You cannot have a failure at the pin. You cannot have a failure of anything, you know, anything in that mast. It has to be in the BRBs. So we put in all kinds of safety factors to make sure that the pin is not the weak link in the system.
Makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Do you see mast frames becoming more common in a high-rise or just urban seismic design?
I am not too hopeful about that. I'm not too optimistic about that. That's because I know Leo, my partner, has been working with AISC to try to working with also Professor Barbara Simpson over at Stanford and trying to get this system adopted as one of the lateral systems in the code. And the fact that it's hard to design the mast to remain reliably elastic using conventional, you know, elastic methods of analysis is a real impediment. So I think until we have a better handle on how to design the mast without doing time history analysis, it seems like it's not likely to be, you know, adopted as an industry, widely in the industry. I wouldn't be surprised if engineers like us who do time history analysis, who, you know, will get comfortable with it. You may know structural engineers are a little bit not conservative, not politically, but conservative to you know, try something new.
Yeah. Worked last time and we don't want to do it any different.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
So, I mean, I think it's maybe in 10 years or something, you know, on the 10-year horizon, it becomes something.
Yeah.
You know? But I think it's going to be some time before it's really adopted.
Yeah, I'd really like to see it used, but that makes, you know, it's just not, we are not a quick profession in changes, which I think is a good thing. Are there any lessons from this project that you could apply to other building types or seismic systems?
Well, one of the things that I discovered in the building that we're doing currently is that we have a basement in that building, and I knew this before, but when a frame comes down through a basement and you have lateral fixity that reacts off the ground floor slab, the ground floor slab takes a lot of load, and the stiffness of that whole system is very touchy and hard to quantify. So that was probably one of the biggest issues that I dealt with. And what's interesting is that there's an interplay with that diaphragm and also the foundation. So the more load the diaphragm takes, the less the foundation overturning is, and the punching shear and all that. That was a major issue. The other thing that I've mentioned here it's still, I don't know about a lesson, but my eyes are more open to it, is that again, the mast is hard to control. It's hard to control the demands in the mast because of this upper mode shaking, and so we're still in the process of learning how to create a design that's not so sensitive to changes in the architecture or something that causes us to move the mass around a little bit, and all of a sudden, you know, our mass frame elements have to get bigger, you know, by a size or two or something. So those are things that we're working on. I'm considering putting in dampers instead of or like putting in a hybrid system with dampers and BRBs. We'll probably try that on a current project that we're working on, at least study it a little bit, as a means of it, you know, trying to again really go easier on the mast. The mast is the hard piece, is trying to quantify that. We've also considered putting other sorts of masts in there, like a concrete wall in parallel with the BRBs. So that's something we'll do, because concrete pound for pound is much better in taking the shear demands. So, you know, if we could figure out a way to deal with the different trades and things, that might be a good solution. The collector demands, you know, we've learned a decent amount about that. You know, collectors are vexing too, because they have those are collector beams that are carrying gravity load as well as having the seismic demands. And in time history analysis, you have to take you run 11 ground motions and get the, you know, average of the MCE ground motions, and then factor that average by 1.3 and then add it to the gravity loads. It ends up, again, it's like, you know, it's everything is so integrated that it becomes a situation where something changes in the gravity frame, and all of a sudden you have to rerun the time history analysis and process the
result. Yeah.
So, you know, we're trying to figure out ways to keep our lives sane so that we're not having to rerun that thing all the time and reprocess all the data. And unfortunately, I don't have a ton of answers yet, just a lot of things that we're looking at, you know.
Yeah, it's gonna make it just much harder to apply this in a code sense. It's like, mm-hmm. there are any change affects the system dramatically. Yeah. So
yeah, but I would say like a lot of these things are also present in conventional systems, but we've accepted the system, and so we never even look at it. And that's one of the things that's really hard for me, is I do feel like when we go through peer review and we're trying to create this design, we're held to a higher standard because of it's a new innovative system. But many of the things that we're dealing with would be worse with a conventional system if we actually looked at it, you know. so much for it. I don't know. I enjoy it anyway. I think it's great, and we're paying the price for our innovations.
All right. Can I hit you with some closing questions here? You can answer them as quick as you want, because we've touched a lot of them already. Yeah. But what surprised you the most during the design and analysis of the mass frame system? What was unique to you?
Well, one of the critical thing it has to do with this rocking piece. So you have to really just think through how the rocking works out. And so, you know, at the base, we've tried to deal with it without putting a pin, to deal with that rocking without putting in a pin. And some of the moments they just get out of hand. It's hard to really quantify. So those are some things that we've really wrestled with. I feel like we can actually do it without a pin, and it can be more conventional. And so that worked out pretty well on the current building that we're doing, and I feel good about that. And so it didn't have to be so much like, if you look at the SMU details compared to what we're doing on this current one, which is a Baker lab, Baker's a donor. The details are simpler, much simpler. And so I feel good about that. I feel not necessarily surprised, but glad that we're able to come up with something else that looks more conventional. I'd mention again that big surprise, it's not even necessarily related to the mass frame, but just how a lateral system going down into a basement reacts off that diaphragm. Really, really had to strengthen the diaphragm beyond what we normally would have. That literally surprised me. I did not expect so much of a change on that. I was quite surprised also at how well the system performs when I did do some comparison with a conventional brace frame system. It was able to get much better performance for the same BRBs, or get equivalent performance with weaker BRBs. And so that was a delightful surprise too.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. If you were starting the project over again today, would you change anything?
I would have definitely looked at that diaphragm earlier. I didn't look at it until we were into DD, and I should have looked at it in SD. Through peer review, we ended up doing a collector solution that I am not super happy about. We did a top flange, like a welded top flange connection to the rocking frames. And I think if I had it to do over again, I probably would have put pins in certain locations rather than these top welded flange things. We did end up going through a process where we optimized the system too, and I would have done that earlier. We did that in order to balance torsion. We were struggling with torsion because of the architecture and whatnot. I don't know if I would ever have had much control over that anyway, but the fact was we had to put the frames in a certain place that was just causing the building to twist, and I could not find a balance point. So I would have pushed harder on the architect to try to, you know, really balance these things out, because I know that it can be quite painful if you don't.
Yeah. Okay. If you were talking to someone that was working on this style of project right now, or just kicking off, mm-hmm. what lessons learned could you give them? Would you give them before getting into something like this?
Well, there's one practical lesson that I would want people to know about, and that is that it has to do with the anchorage to the foundation. We had an assembly of gussets and things. And essentially this one connection would be taking half the lateral load of the entire building through this one connection. And I think that whole assembly weighed like 15,000 pounds. It was like a massive amount of steel. And the contractor's trying to figure out how they're going to get it in and how they're going to be able to, it has to be embedded in the concrete. But then it also has to be, it has to work with the tolerances, with the braces that are supposed to connect to it. And we had to redesign the connection because we had welded the gussets to the rebar in the mat. And then once you've specified that, you have no way of leveling it or moving it at all. And what we should have done and what we'll do in the future is create basically a steel box for that thing to sit in. And that steel box would take the shear out, and then we would have oversized holes for in the base plates for the threaded rods to hold it down vertically. So that I would just say, think about like at your brace frame connections, just make sure that you have a way for the contractor to level them and move them around. They were saying they need like a half an inch of movement. So not easy when you have a 15,000 pound assembly. Yeah. So that's one lesson I would say. And then the other one is, it's not so hard to actually run a nonlinear analysis. If I were young again, I would spend a weekend reading a manual at my job and trying to figure out how to do it on my off time so I could run a time history analysis of a single frame, and just kind of get to know that. Cause I'm constantly surprised whenever I run a time history analysis. I always run into some surprise, and that can be both delightful and upsetting, because you think the world, you think you understand the world, and then it throws a curveball at you. So my recommendation is that you would get into that and learn it, and that'll open up avenues for innovation for things like this,
Thank you so much, Mike. This is, and for those listening, we were actually going to have a time history episode coming up soon, but I do not know how this works at all. So the mass frame is so creative and just really exciting to learn about. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.